I think gerrymandering is the basis of what takes place.
Even Ronald Reagan didn't like gerrymandering. Don't tell Republicans.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It certainly is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica
with you.
Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. As well, we also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Detour Talk, and many other fine affiliates blanketing planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. And so, we meet again. Thank you for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Got some breaking news here as we go to air today, but happily, it's not as horrible as so much of the breaking news that tends to happen right before airtime.
Well, okay.
So there's that.
There's some,
right?
Some good-ish
things are
news.
Already looking good. Hello, Desi Doyen. How are
Hi.
You holding up today?
Doing okay.
All right. So it's actually not terrible news, though it is not as good news as many folks might see it as. In normal times, I think this might be seen as potentially very good news. These are not, however, normal times.
So you're saying there's a dark lining to that cloud?
Kinda. Or a less than bright lining, as it appears at first. In any event, folks may be seeing the headline that a federal court has struck down Kentucky's new Medicaid work rules. That's good. But I would caution that people should be cautious before celebrating too much here for at least two reasons. But let's start with that breaking news in any event so people actually understand it. According to the New York Times, a federal judge on Friday blocked Kentucky's closely watched plan to require Medicaid recipients to work or volunteer or train for a job as a condition of coverage for Medicaid. Federal Judge James E. Boasberg of the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia, who is an Obama appointee, he ruled that the Trump administration's approval of Kentucky's scheme was, quote, arbitrary and capricious because it had not adequately considered, among other things, whether the plan would actually, quote, help the state furnish medical assistance to its citizens, which, the judge notes, is the central objective of Medicaid. So Medicaid is not meant as a job program. It's not meant to encourage people to go find work or to get better jobs, since most of the people, by the way, who have Medicaid are already working. But Kentucky's scheme would require Medicaid recipients to do much more. They would have to pay monthly premiums, some of them. So even if you had a job, you would still have to come up with the money to pay these monthly premiums, which they may not be able to afford. And that is even if they are already working. All of this requiring folks to work, etc., is decidedly not what Congress meant when they passed Medicaid or its expansion under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. So for 50 years since the passage of Medicaid, it has been for health care. It has not been to somehow encourage people to go to work or to change jobs or anything like that. Congress meant to help people have health care. It's a social safety net program. So, you know, we've got these Republicans and Supreme Court justices who are now pretending that they are most concerned about what did lawmakers mean when they passed a certain measure. What was exactly what did the founders have in mind when they said certain things in the Constitution? Well, clearly, when Medicaid was passed 50 years ago, or when the expansion of Medicaid was passed, it was not passed as a job program. That was not the point of the legislators who passed those laws. So, the judge says, this is completely inappropriate to add these new requirements. And in this case, they did no investigation, no study whatsoever to determine that somehow this would improve access to health care for people, which is the objective of Medicaid. But this idea that, we should follow the laws as they are actually written, well, that's something that Republicans only seem to care about in certain cases.
Yeah, they only care about it when it manages to redound to their
help
benefit.
Them. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or, when they're just talking about it and then behind their constituents' backs, they go ahead and do what they wanted to do in the first place.
Exactly.
Anyway, it's just words.
So basically, the judge said that what the Trump administration here is doing is rewriting the law. So, yes, it's a movable standard, it seems, for Republicans these days, unless you think Medicaid was somehow meant to encourage people to get jobs. But there are several reasons here. So this is good news from the federal courts, but several reasons to not get too excited just yet about Judge Boasberg's ruling here. The ruling in the Kentucky case is the first on this issue, but it will almost certainly not be the last. There are several other states where this is also being done. And the question, of course, may wind up, almost certainly will wind up, before the U.S. Supreme Court, a more right-wing U.S. Supreme Court that will, by the time this gets there, most likely be have two now, count them, two extreme Donald Trump appointees, unless Democrats can figure out how to put the brakes on that somehow. For now, there are three other states which have also already received permission from the Trump administration to impose work requirements on Medicaid. Seven more have asked for clearance to do so. Moreover, Kentucky's Tea Party governor, Matt Bevin of Kentucky, a vocal opponent, a Republican, it goes without saying, and a vocal opponent of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, has said that if he loses this case in the courts, he will simply end the Medicaid expansion entirely in Kentucky. So either do it my way with these work requirements that have nothing to do with law, or we will take health care away from hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians. Do it my way or the poor people get it. And by the way, the poor people were going to get it anyway, even if this measure was allowed to move forward. It was set to begin on Sunday, and it would have it's estimated that it would have resulted in some 264,000 Kentuckians losing access to health care in the next month alone. Requiring Medicaid recipients to work and to pay monthly premiums, which is also part of the Kentucky plan, would significantly reduce the number of people with coverage in the state. Many experts predict that either because they will be deemed able to work but are not working, or to volunteer but will not volunteer, or because they don't keep up with their premium payments, or provide documentation every single month to prove that they worked the required 80 hours. So it's not enough that you're working. It's not enough that you're paying the premiums. This extra burden on those who are already working to stay alive, but they're not making enough to afford health care, even under Obamacare, They would now have to start proving month after month after month that, yes, they are working 80 hours each month. So this is your Republican Party today. This is in Kentucky, where the Affordable Care Act, which they called Connect down there, is actually wildly popular, even though many in the state don't realize that it's actually Obamacare. They just put that state name on it, Connect, K-Y-Necked. It was put in place, by the way, by the previous governor before Matt Bevin. It was put in place by a Democratic governor in the state. It was very, very popular. But Matt Bevin, the Tea Party guy, came in and basically wants to kill all of it. This is your Republican Party today. And this is in Kentucky, where the Affordable Care Act is, you know, very popular, wildly popular, even if they don't realize that it's Obamacare. Just another part of the Republican war on its own voters.
Yeah, no kidding. And also, am I wrong? But it doesn't seem like this is going to create any jobs at all. So how do you prove you're working 80 hours a week if there are no jobs that you can get because there are no jobs to get?
I know. No, it's just punitive.
Yeah,
it's just punitive.
It's punishing the poor.
Just to be mean. That's what they do. They do it to their own people.
And what gets me more than anything is these people call themselves Christians.
We're seeing something similar also in play from Christian Donald Trump's trade wars against friends and foes alike. Republicans in the House and Senate could prevent, in an afternoon, they could stop this. They could put an end to Donald Trump's ongoing and increasing trade war. If they wanted to, in the Republican-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, they could just pass legislation to require congressional approval for trade tariffs. But they ain't doing it, even as it's now starting to cost American jobs. And even if many Republicans pretend that they are against what the president is doing. I don't know if you've noticed, by the way, but over the past 2 weeks or so, since mid-June, since Donald Trump's tariffs began kicking in, the Dow Jones average has dived about 1,300 points, or about 5%. So the markets have certainly noticed what's going on. It's unclear if Trump supporters, most of whom do not actually have stocks or pay attention to the daily markets, unclear whether they have noticed. But they may start noticing soon once they start losing jobs. We talked a week or so ago about how retaliation against Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum are already hurting the nation's farmers, many of whom were big supporters of Trump back in 2016, particularly in key states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, where GOP advocacy groups are now actually running ads against Trump and his escalating trade war. Those farmers, as we reported a week or so ago, are taking a big hit while Canada and China and other nations are placing their own tariffs on U.S. crops or stopped importing them altogether. And now we have news this past week of more damage inflicted on Americans from Trump's extreme trade policies. The first casualties of President Trump's trade war are apparently 60 workers at Mid-Continent Nail. This is America's largest nail manufacturer. They lost their jobs last week at a factory in a part of Missouri that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. The whole company, according to its owner, could now be out of business by Labor Day. This is a potential game changer in Trump's trade strategy, Washington Post's Heather Long argues at the paper's Wonk blog, especially if it marks the start of more companies announcing layoffs. On Monday, Harley-Davidson had said it will be moving some production offshore because of the trade war. Europe had hit Harley with a 31% tariff in response to Trump's steel tariffs against Europe. So to be clear, a 31% tariff means essentially that people in Europe will have to pay 31% more to buy an American-made Harley-Davidson. So that's going to hurt Harley-Davidson. So they're moving some of their production elsewhere as to try to avoid those tariffs. But that means that layoffs may also be ahead for American Harley-Davidson workers in, yes, Paul Ryan's Wisconsin. The Trump administration has argued that these tariffs will save jobs and that the cost to America will be minor. But now we've got some real job losses here and a human face for the pain that many trade experts are warning about and saying could get much, much worse. The political pressure on Trump to stop the tariffs, especially on America's allies, like the European Union, Canada, Mexico, and so forth, that is likely to escalate, says the Post. In Missouri, a state with a very close U.S. Senate race this year, those layoffs are already becoming a hot election issue at that nail company. Senator Claire McCaskill is visiting the nail plant, I believe, today. Mid-Continent Nail blames the layoffs squarely on Trump's tariffs. The company says that all 500 employees could lose their jobs by Labor Day and that the next round of cuts could come any day now. The trouble started at the end of May, apparently, when Trump put this 25% tariff on steel imports, steel coming from Mexico and Canada. Mid-Continent had been importing steel from Mexico that their American workers would then use to turn into nails. But after the tariff, the company had to hike their prices, customers fled, and now orders are a mere 30% of what they were a year ago, said the vice president of sales, George Skerich. Not 30% off what they were last year, but a mere 30% of what they were last year.
In other words, a 70% drop.
There you go. Good math. He says Vice President Skerich says that he suspects many customers are now buying Chinese nails instead. Hey, that worked out well, Mr. Trump. Well done.
Make China great again.
Jesus. There's a lot of uncertainty and a ton of fear in Poplar Bluff, says Skerich. That's the home to Mid-Continent. And I should note here that Poplar Bluff, Missouri, is not far from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, which is the original hometown of Rush Limbaugh. Just to, if that gives you any idea of the area that we're kind of talking about here in rural Missouri. Skerich says he voted for Trump. He says he's disappointed and sad at what's happened to a town and a company that he loves. If he had a minute with Trump, Skerich says, according to the Washington Post, he'd tell him that these tariffs aren't hurting China. They're hurting Missouri. The workers who lost their jobs in mid-June were contract workers, middle-class jobs in Poplar Bluff, where the median income is about $31,000 a year. The Tax Foundation predicts 48,500 job losses from the tariffs that Trump has already enacted on imports of washing machines, solar panels, steel, aluminum, $50 billion in Chinese products. And that figure would soar to, according to the Tax Foundation, would soar to more than 250,000 job losses if Trump moves forward with tariffs on another $200 billion of Chinese products, as Trump threatened to do a few days ago in response to China retaliating here. The Wonk blog notes that the longer the tariffs are in place, the more companies are likely to have to make cuts. Experts have warned Trump that the tariffs are likely to cause more job losses than jobs saved, and the early signs of that are now starting to play out in small towns south of my old hometown of St. Louis. That's not the only place where this is going to start causing problems. General Motors warned on Friday that if Trump pushes forward with another wave of tariffs, as he's threatened, that the move could lead to less investment, fewer jobs, and lower wages. And yes, by the way, there are some GM plants in Missouri as well. The automaker said that tariffs on imports of cars and car parts could drive up prices by thousands of dollars, and the hardest hit vehicles said in GM said in comments that were submitted to the Commerce Department are often the ones bought by consumers who can least afford it. Demand would suffer, production would slow, all of which could lead to a smaller GM, they said. So this could get worse and worse. And I know that this is something that very few people are talking about because we're all distracted with his terrible border policies, what's going on at the Supreme Court, But there's some very real stuff, some rumblings that are happening to this economy that could see the bottom drop out if Donald Trump is not stopped here somehow. Just more reason for folks to put the brakes on this administration, including folks that once supported Donald Trump. Whether enough of them show up to vote this November to change the balance of the House or Senate, that's still the question of the year. And over the past 2 weeks, the Supreme Court has made that somewhat harder. No matter how many more voters may show up to vote for Democrats, Democrats may actually still not be able to take back the U.S. House. With the announcement of Justice Kennedy's retirement, the fight to restore U.S. House and state legislative voting districts that actually represent the people who live in them, rather than the partisan majorities who drew the maps in the first place, that fight may have just gotten much more difficult. We'll be joined by the National Redistricting Manager at Common Cause, whose case to have all of North Carolina's U.S. House districts tossed out and redrawn in a nonpartisan way before 2018. That was a successful case until it reached the U.S. Supreme Court. And over this past week, that ruling to draw new U.S. House districts before 2018, well, it didn't get killed, but it got sent back down to the federal appeals court. So that ain't happening for 2018. We'll be joined by the National Redistricting Manager at Common Cause who brought that case next on the broadcast to discuss that and where this fight to end partisan gerrymandering even can go from here. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Last week, I think it was, we played some audio from the Republicans' sainted President Ronald Reagan back in 1988, describing those politicians who favored trade wars as demagogues who were cynically waving the American flag. Sound like anyone you know? It's not just on trade on which the GOP has moved far to the right of their beloved Ronald Reagan. If they had an ounce of intellectual honesty, I suspect they'd probably have to call Reagan an anti-American Marxist or something at this point, compared to what has become of their party. By way of one more piece of evidence there along those lines, here's Ronald Reagan decrying gerrymandered voting districts. Way back in 1988, side by side with Barack Obama in his 2016 State of the Union address, saying almost exactly the very same thing.
I think that this is a great conflict of interest. To ask men holding office, elected from districts, to change the lines of that district to fit the new population, I think gerrymandering is the basis of what takes place.
I think we've got to end the practice of drawing our congressional districts so that politicians can pick their voters and not the other way around.
By the way, that was Reagan in 1988 calling it gerrymandering because it was a term coined after the Massachusetts legislature way back in 1812. Drew a map with districts in which one was so ridiculously drawn it looked like a salamander in support of the Democratic Republican Party candidates of Governor Elbridge Gerry over the Federalist Party at the time. So combining Elbridge Gerry and salamanders, Reagan is technically correct to call it gerrymander, though most of us call it gerrymanders by now. But he was definitely correct, along with Obama, about the idea that state legislators shouldn't be able to pick which voters will be able to vote on their own re-elections. The U.S. Supreme Court has, at least in previous years, found certain gerrymanders based on racially divided redistricting, which suppress minority voting power, to be unconstitutional and a violation of the Voting Rights Act. That changed at least a little bit this past week, at least for several state legislative districts found by federal courts to be racial gerrymanders drawn by Republicans in Texas. In just one of the Supreme Court's recent disturbing 5-4 rulings by its stolen GOP majority. They approved those districts. That just prior to swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy announcing his retirement. And then there are partisan gerrymanders, where parties create state legislative and U.S. House maps in a way to give the party drawing them outsized power over the minority party in question. Since 2010, as you know, that has largely been Republicans who have drawn extreme partisan gerrymanders in any number of states. While the Supreme Court has determined racial gerrymanders can be unlawful, they have yet to rule on whether strictly partisan gerrymanders are unconstitutional. They had several opportunities this past term to finally make a determination on that, but they didn't. 2 weeks ago, the Supremes punted back two separate cases to lower courts, one in which a federal appeals court found Wisconsin's entire state legislative map needed to be redrawn because it was unfairly preventing Democratic voters from having their voices heard. And they also sent back a case in Maryland where Democrats admit to having redrawn a Republican U.S. House district in order to flip it to a Democrat. And then this past week, 5 years to the day after the decision in Shelby v. Holder, in which the Supreme Court gutted a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the stolen court celebrated by not only striking down the rulings against those racial gerrymanders in Texas, but the court also sent back a federal appeals court ruling in North Carolina, which had ordered the state's entire U.S. House map to be redrawn in time for the 2018 midterm elections, after the entire map was found to be a partisan gerrymander. Republicans in the state even admitted as much. North Carolina State Rep. David Lewis, a Republican member of the North Carolina General Assembly who drew the map, said, quote, "I think electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats, so I drew this map to help foster what I think is better for the country. I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats." Well, Lewis's strategy worked as designed. The GOP won 10 U.S. House seats to the Democrats' 3 in the 2016 election, even though statewide, the narrowly divided swing state chose Democrats for both governor and attorney general in that same year. But hey, at least it wasn't a racial gerrymander in North Carolina, right? The SCOTUS decision to punt the appeals court ruling back down so the North Carolina U.S. House map can't be redrawn before the crucial 2018 midterm election, as the appeals court had ordered, was a huge blow to the earlier victory of the challengers in Common Cause versus Rucho, regarded by many as the case that could finally put an end to extreme partisan redistricting once and for all in the U.S. And now with Justice Kennedy out, even if the case returns to the Supreme Court next year, they could rule 5-4 under a new, even farther right court that partisan gerrymandering is perfectly lawful and constitutional, as Kennedy was very much thought to have been the one who could finally vote with the court's liberals to end the practice. Here to explain what all of this means and doesn't moving forward and where the fight for fair voting districts stands now that Kennedy's leaving the court is Common Cause's own national redistricting manager, Dan Vicuna. Dan, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wish I could say congratulations on Common Cause versus Rucho, but I guess we can't this week. Can you explain what actually happened to that North Carolina case this week? Because I know many saw it as a very clear-cut case that might finally allow the court to deal with partisan gerrymandering once and for all. Under what premise did the stolen 5-4 majority, as I call it, punt the case back down to the federal appeals court this week?
Well, it starts with a different case, the case you mentioned, Gill v. Whitford, the challenge to Wisconsin's assembly map. In that case, you know, as you described, the court punted. They decided not to hear the merits of the claim, the First Amendment and 14th Amendment challenge to the very blatant partisan gerrymander in Wisconsin, because what they said was that the plaintiffs there had not established their standing to sue. It's sort of somewhat a very kind of technical excuse for not approaching the heart of the matter. They said that the plaintiffs were taking on a statewide challenge to the district, and what they needed to do was demonstrate that individual plaintiffs had the right to sue, standing to sue, by showing that their particular district had been manipulated in a way that diluted their ability to effectively elect candidates of their choice. Mm. So we, the Common Cause v. Russo plaintiffs, also we're consolidated with a different case, League of Women Voters of North Carolina, mm-hmm. v. Russo. We were sort of saddled with that decision, or that non-decision, I guess, yeah. as the case may be. They said, we don't know that you have standing. Our view is, we have hit all the important points that the majority opinion in that laid out. We have a statewide defendant, the North Carolina Democratic Party, on our side. We have established individual plaintiffs in every congressional district. We've described their individual harm within the district. We think we basically have no Gil v. Whitford problem. However, the Supreme Court said differently. They sent it back to the three-judge panel to rehear the issue of standing in our case. Mm. And fortunately, the one good thing moving forward is that I think the trial court, having seen what an egregious, arrogant move the North Carolina legislature made when they explicitly said they were going to draw these districts for partisan advantage, they want to move quickly. They have set very quick deadlines to get briefing done, July 11th, and hopefully turn this back around and get it back up to the Supreme Court. I mean, as you mentioned, it's going to be a tougher road. We don't know who Justice Kennedy's replacement will be, but that doesn't mean we're not going to give up this fight. So hopefully it'll be up back to the Supreme Court sometime next term.
And I want to talk about that and that strategy and what to expect with a new justice in instead of Kennedy. But this case in North Carolina, I mean, I read that quote from State Rep. David Lewis, admitting that this was done for partisan reasons. You have on your Twitter feed today, Dan Vicuña, this comment from that same state rep, David Lewis, saying, quote, "We have made clear this whole time in the court that politics was not the predominant factor in the drawing of the 2016 congressional map, one of many established criteria." His comment earlier seems to be the exact opposite of that. No, am I missing something there?
It sounds to me like your classic Trump era alternative fact. I mean, he was on tape, very explicit, saying that the intent of this map would be to give Republicans 10 of 13 seats, and now he's trying to walk that back. It's very strange, but it's consistent with the arrogance of the North Carolina legislature from day one. Mind you, that the reason why they redrew these maps in 2016, late in a census redistricting cycle, is because their original map was struck down as an illegal racial gerrymander. They are currently sitting in districts themselves that have been determined to be an illegal racial gerrymander. They've had districts struck down. They've attempted to gerrymander local districts, a couple of cities in North Carolina, a school district, to ensure Republican dominance. So, the arrogance sort of knows no bounds, and it's indicative of the way legislators across the country view the power to manipulate these maps for their own advantage.
And speaking of that, the North Carolina, the Wisconsin, the Maryland cases I mentioned that were all sort of punted to a later day, and we'll talk about that day in a second here with swing vote Kennedy now gone. But the court this past week also approved these racial gerrymanders that were drawn in Texas, even though racial gerrymanders, unlike partisan gerrymanders, had been found unconstitutional by the court in the past. On what basis did the court say that these racial gerrymanders in Texas were just fine? And I guess I kind of want to ask, how is it they got Kennedy to go along with them? But at this point, we've seen, he went with that right-wing stolen majority a whole lot in this past term. But what happened to racial gerrymandering? I thought we all agreed at least that was unlawful.
Yeah, I mean, before this case, the jurisprudence on racial gerrymandering was fairly strong. The justices have seen that, you know, across the country, you know, in the case of Republican-drawn districts, what Republican-led legislatures have tended to do is try to pack minority communities into a very, very few number of districts so that they can get the candidate of their choice by an overwhelming margin, you know, winning 80% of the vote, and but also to ensure that those communities have absolutely no power over surrounding districts, you know, to minimize their power into just one district or a couple of districts. And you know, you saw that approach and also a cracking approach in Texas. You know, it was packing and cracking Latino communities, African-American communities, either into very few districts, both at the state House level and the U.S. House level, the congressional level, or dividing them up to the extent that they could, you know, slice up a Latino community into several different districts, ensuring that they had, not enough power in any single district. It was a very effective way for Republicans to maintain partisan control of the congressional delegation and the legislative delegation. So, a trial court, you saw through that. A three-judge panel ruled those districts to be unconstitutional under the Voting Rights Act and also the 14th Amendment Equal Protection. They attempted to sort of address the most egregious portions of the map, the worst outlier districts, quickly enough for the 2012 election. However, many of those the districts that had been racially gerrymandered were untouched. The court just didn't have the fact-finding time to get to them. The legislature said, "Hey, this is great. This wasn't that much of a change," and they, in 2013, approved the districts, voted the redrawn districts in as the new districts for Texas. But when the case went to a full trial, the trial court said, "Well, we did our best to fix these for 2012, but there are still problems." And the legislature, you know, is trying to make attempted to make the case, and successfully did so, that somehow there was some sort of magic happened between their racial gerrymander of 2011 and their approval of basically the same district 2 years later. The Supreme Court has issued a ruling in Abbott v. Perez, this Texas case, that is going to have some serious implications down the road. They're calling on courts to give a lot of deference to legislators in a way that legislators don't deserve. They will easily throw minority communities under the bus for partisan advantage. And when the Supreme Court issued this decision out of Texas, they said, "Well, we're still going to, you know, let them do their thing, give them deference, assume they have the best intentions." And it's going to make it a lot harder to challenge racial gerrymanders in the future.
Which is, you know, really disturbing, because we thought the fight was sort of on partisan gerrymanders, and it turns out that there's still fights over racial gerrymanders. And just this notion that both you heard at the top there, both Ronald Reagan himself and Barack Obama decrying that, you know, that these legislators cannot fix the problem that they themselves created, that we need the courts to step in and take action here. And these disappointing rulings over the past 2 weeks all came, I should note, when Justice Kennedy was still on the court. Much was, you know, riding on him agreeing to finally nix partisan gerrymanders, much less racial ones. He indicated in the past he'd like to do that, but now he didn't. Now he's gone. So what does this mean for the hopes of the Supreme Court at this point ever blocking partisan gerrymanders, Dan, or worse, just, you know, approving them to be just fine, as the GOPers in the North Carolina case, for example, have admitted that they did? This seems like very bad news, is what I'm getting at.
I think it is likely to make our path, you know, through litigation more difficult. On the flip side, what it does serves as a useful reminder that the courts will not necessarily save us. And so the good news is that there is amazing grassroots energy to address this problem, which, you know, when I first started doing this work just 4 years ago, was a relatively sort of sleepy, quiet, you know, wonky issue that not a lot of people talked about.
Right.
And And but now what we're seeing, you know, is new energy to fix the problem through the states, through ballot initiatives. Fortunately, there are states that have ballot initiatives. You know, in Ohio, just last month, mm-hmm. voters approved really strong bipartisan protections to ensure that one party can't steamroll the other in the drawing of congressional districts. They had already passed reforms a couple of years before on state legislative districts. There's going to be a ballot initiative that was just given approval to go on the ballot in Michigan to create an independent citizens redistricting commission, which the notion behind that is that you find a number of people around the state who don't have direct conflicts of interest, a direct personal stake in the drawing of districts, give them strict criteria, nonpartisan criteria, to draw districts, you know, based on community input, the Voting Rights Act, prohibiting the use or giving it one party or candidate an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see the same sort of model on the ballot in Colorado and Utah as well. In Missouri, there's a good government measure that also includes ethics provisions, campaign finance reform, and the creation of a nonpartisan demographer to draw districts, ensuring that there's partisan fairness. So although you know the court rulings have been incredibly disappointing and the future is uncertain, I think it will drive energy to do something at the grassroots, increase energy that we've already seen this year.
There has, been, you know, despite federal court after federal court finding these partisan gerrymanders in one state after another over the past year, several years, to, you know, the lower courts finding them, federal courts finding them in violation of voting rights and the Constitution. It seems like the only gerrymandering ruling that did survive this year was the one brought in state court in Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court tossed out the entire U.S. House map and drew a new one for 2018 after finding the GOP maps there also violated the state law and the state constitution. Does this suggest that the state the path forward here, at least in the courts, could now be in state courts? Or is that because there was a special mechanism in Pennsylvania only in their state law or state constitution that allowed the case to be brought to the state court?
So, well, Pennsylvania was a fascinating case in terms of a litigation strategy because the Pennsylvania Constitution had a provision. It was called their Free and Equal Elections Clause. It was one that, in fact, predated the U.S. Constitution. So what the plaintiffs in that case argument that they made was that, you know, this is a distinct and stronger protection for Pennsylvania voters than even the federal First Amendment or the 14th Amendment provides. And, you know, Pennsylvania is one of the many states where the number of Republicans and Democrats who have been elected does not in any way really reflect the makeup of the state. You know, Pennsylvania
right.
has most recently famously been a Democratic state and went to President Trump in 2016. It's fairly split down the middle. It's got a Democratic governor, you know, but one Republican senator.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that they drew the congressional map was a clear distortion of what the politics of the state are, giving Republicans districts far out of proportion to the vote that they get. And so the litigators said, look, we're going to go to the state Supreme Court. We're going to litigate on this fair and equal elections provision. And they succeeded. The court said, in fact, there was a distinct legal sort of history that went with the Pennsylvania Constitution's provision that provides stronger protections to the voters of the state. And they won, and Pennsylvania is getting a new congressional map this year. And in the brief that the plaintiffs wrote, they noted that I think it's 18 or 19 states that have some sort of similar provision, you know, that provides
right.
A protection for voters that's distinct from the federal First Amendment and 14th Amendment. So I think litigators will have to look at every state Supreme Court to determine whether, it's a court that's likely to be friendly to this approach. But it's definitely an option in more places than just Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and I think it's going to have to be given the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court and where that seems to be headed. In Pennsylvania, of course, many have said that Democrats can expect to pick up three or four seats just by the redrawn maps that the state Supreme Court has required them to use for 2018. But given that almost all of the other partisan and racial gerrymanders that have been put in place are still in place during the midterms in 2018, how does that affect the likelihood of Dems being able to win back the House, even if there is a so-called blue wave, Dan Vicuña?
Well, I'll just, you know, of course, for starters, have to, you know, lay out Common Cause's nonpartisan credentials.
Right.
You know, institutionally, we're not rooting for anybody. But, you know, what we are rooting for is, you know, the House of Representatives to be representative of the politics, you know, of the country, for mm-hmm. each delegation to be representative of the politics, you know, of the state, and that for that to be done through a, you know, process of drawing districts that is driven not by the needs of incumbent electeds or party hacks, but by communities. And, you know, I think there is a high likelihood that the House of Representatives will, you know, not look like what the actual politics are of the country because there are so many districts and mm-hmm. so many states that have districts that are drawn by legislators, you know, themselves. In many cases, you have legislators probably now running in the districts that they helped to craft. So, I mean, it's a definite problem when you don't see our democracy being responsive to changes in voter opinion. If there's a wave one way or the other, voters should be able to express dissatisfaction in a way that actually affects change in who the representatives are. But when district or gerrymander, that just doesn't happen.
And you know, I wasn't even asking on a partisan basis. I'm looking back at, you know, these elections where we've seen in recent years, since the 2010 redistricting, where we're seeing, you know, more voters actually turning out for Democrats and yet Republicans still hanging on to power in the U.S. House. So that's why I'm trying to get a sense of how big, if there is a so-called blue wave, and I am, well, I'm still dubious about that, but if there is a so-called blue wave, I mean, how much bigger does it have to be in order to change the actual balance of the House? Is there any numbers, statistics, political science on that to give a sense of what would actually be required at this point to flip the House?
You know, I've seen estimates, you know, that may range from about maybe 54% the Democrats would have to win in terms of a popular vote majority to mm-hmm. actually win. It could be higher because, you know, a lot of these states, you know, the gerrymander of the congressional delegation is quite a firewall. I mean, you saw something like this in Virginia where mm-hmm. sort of the start of our, you know, the kind of Democratic reaction to the president, mm-hmm. You know, was in last year's Virginia elections. And you know, Democrats were unable to win the House of Delegates. I think they had something like a 9-point advantage in the popular vote mm-hmm. and came one seat shy of a majority. So, I mean, gerrymandering absolutely serves as a firewall to Democratic accountability, to responsiveness to the views of the electorate.
Now, the other side of that, and I got just a minute or two left here, Dan, but if Democrats do win back the U.S. House, does that subsequently hurt future arguments that these districts are gerrymandered? Because, hey, after all, look, Democrats, they took back the House anyway, so things couldn't be that bad. There's no real problem here when it comes to partisan gerrymanders in the U.S. Is that a concern?
A couple quick things on that point. I mean, I'd say it's very likely to take an extraordinary wave for Democrats to win a bare majority in the House. So I don't know that that is any demonstration that you know, the manipulation of the process isn't a problem. But secondly, kind of most importantly, you know, Common Cause's primary interest in the redistricting reform is that it is not a community, people-driven process. You know, sort of the partisan outcome of the district is more of a secondary concern, but primarily why we want to see independent commissions or nonpartisan standards or models where, you know, sort of nonpartisan staff draw districts mm-hmm. is less about those electoral outcomes than it is about the public having a meaningful say in their own representation.
Right.
So that's sort of our goal going forward, and we're excited to see that at least in a handful of states, regardless of how badly things are going on the litigation front, in a handful of states, you're seeing some real movement.
Last question, Dan. What, if anything, can people, the voters here who are being denied equal representation, equal protection rights here, what can the voters actually do to help in this fight? Above and beyond showing up in droves to vote this year and in 2020?
In a lot of states, there are active redistricting reform campaigns happening. If you go to commoncause.org/redistricting, you can see some of our leaders who are in charge working with community organizations, League of Women Voters, churches, labor in some places, business interests that want to see the process improved and become fair. They are active on many fronts, whether it's through ballot initiatives, knocking on doors, collecting signatures, or in the case where there's not a ballot initiative option, there's public education campaigns, community events where we're teaching people what the problem is of gerrymandering and what some relevant solutions might be. So I think if you can get in touch with one of those reform campaigns that are trying to shame legislators to do the right thing, or get some things passed on the ballot, I think it's a real step in the right direction.
Dan Vicuña, National Redistricting Manager at Common Cause. Check out their work. You can support their efforts there at commoncause.org/redistricting. You can also follow Dan on the Twitters at Dan Vicuña. That's V-I-C-U-N-A. Dan, apologies if I botched pronouncing your name throughout today's show, but I greatly appreciate you joining us and making all of this a little bit clearer as we move forward.
You got there in the end with my name, so thank you.
I'll take it. Thanks, Dan. Okay, quick break, and back with one more story on North Carolina and voting, and speaking of those crazy Republican legislators there, what they're trying to do now. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.
Oh, I love Al Jolson. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Is that song, do we know if it's about South Carolina or North Carolina?
I have no idea.
I always assumed it was South Carolina, but you know what? The way North Carolina is behaving now, they might as well be South Carolina at this point. If there's any state in the union where voters need to show up and toss them out, at the state legislative level this year, it has got to be North Carolina. They just need to be removed and repeal and replace the North Carolina state legislature. Yeah. So North Carolina's photo ID voting restriction law. You remember that? It was actually a huge voter suppression law, not just photo ID, but all sorts of voter suppression stuff. That was struck down by the state Supreme Court in North Carolina a year or two ago after they determined that it was specifically written by the Republicans there in the state legislature to, quote, target minority voters with surgical precision. It was specifically meant in order to depress the votes of minority voters. The law was found to be unconstitutional under the state constitution, so Republicans, who still now control the state legislature, have come up with a new scheme. They want to put it on the ballot as a constitutional amendment, put photo ID voting restrictions on the ballot this year. And as we go to air, it looks like they are just about one step away from being able to do that for 2018. It looks like the measure to require a very specific type of photo ID. These type of laws disproportionately affect minorities and students and the poor, who tend to lean Democratic because it requires the type of ID that they do not have. in order to be able to cast a vote at all. So it looks like this is going to be on the 2018 ballot in this crucial swing state of North Carolina, which Barack Obama won by a very slim margin in 2008. Romney then won by a very slim margin in 2012. Trump won by a slim margin in 2016. So this is a very close state. And, you know, if they can peel off a few voters, a few Democratic voters, that's going to help Republicans a whole lot. So there was a letter to the Raleigh News and Observer this week, which points out yet another way in which voters, in this case, North Carolinians, can be prevented from voting thanks to these type of strict photo ID voting restrictions. Thomas Baer of Chapel Hill writes in to say, having an official voter ID may sound reasonable. Probably 90% of North Carolina citizens already have or can easily get one. But what about the remaining 10%? He says, we ran into problems 2 years ago when we tried to get an ID from the DMV for my brother, who was not in good health and needed an ID to file power of attorney forms. My brother and I immigrated to the U.S. when we were 7 and 11 years old, receiving our citizenship certificates some years later. He says, I still have this document. However, my brother, who went through some rough times, lost his citizenship papers because his birth certificate stated that he was born in Switzerland. The DMV needed proof of his U.S. citizenship. They brought his honorable discharge papers from the Air Force. Yes, he was in the Air Force. His transcript from the University of Illinois showing his social security number, but nothing satisfied the North Carolina DMV requirement to get this ID. He says, we knew his citizenship application number and could have gotten a duplicate, but this would have cost us over $500, at which point we just gave up. How many North Carolina citizens will encounter similar problems in getting IDs, he asks, if, in fact, this requirement is added to the state constitution. Since lawmakers couldn't do it with laws, they're going to change the state constitution if they can get away with it. Hey, voters in North Carolina, don't let them. All right, that's it. Got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Dan Vicuña of Common Cause, to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You're welcome. Though we ask you to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves to continue the good fight as long as we can. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.